Museum in Saratoga Springs, New York. My name is Wayne Clark. Sir, for the record, would you please state your full name and your date and place of birth, please?
Yes. Hector J. Allen. I was born in Troy, New York on March 31st, 1932.
Did you attend school in Troy?
I attended St. Peter's Academy until we moved to St. Johnsville during World War II.
And is that where you completed your high school education?
I graduated from St. Johnsville High School in 1949.
Okay. Now, during World War II, did your family experience any sort of rationing or any hardships because of the war effort?
Well, I was kind of young, but I remember the ration books with the various mm-hmm. red and blue coupons or whatever they were that limited you to certain numbers of pounds of meat and butter and stuff like that. There was all of that, and gasoline rationing too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a faint memory of that.
Did you have any family members that participated in the war?
Yes. My father had died, and my mother... Is that off or on?
We're on. We're okay.
We're on, okay. My father had died, and my mother remarried. My stepfather was in the 106th Division in the Battle of the Bulge. It was a brand new division, and the Germans ran him out, and he was captured. He was a POW until the end of the war.
I see. And as a student in school during the period of the war, did you participate in any of the scrap drives or any efforts like
yes,
that?
Yes. When I still lived in Troy, we gathered up all kinds of aluminum pans and things like that, mm-hmm. various other metal objects, and there was a vacant lot. I lived up Hoosick Street in Troy, Hoosick Street and Oakwood Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And right in that area was a vacant lot, and they piled junk up there for the scrap drives.
Okay. Did you participate in any sort of air raid drills at school at all?
I don't remember any in school, but I remember the air raid drills at home because you had, you know, the sirens would go off, and then everybody had to put the lights out, and there were wardens who came around, knocked on the door if you did not mm-hmm. turn your lights out.
Okay.
I remember some of those.
Was there a lot of celebration when the war did end?
Well, I was in St. Johnsville by that time, and yes, people drove around fire trucks and all that, sirens going. And the bars, there are 8 of them in the little village of St. Johnsville at that time, mm-hmm. and they did a little land office business, I suppose. But I was only 12 years old, so mm-hmm. it did not affect me very much.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you graduated from high school in 1949.
Yes.
Did you go on to college at that point, or what did you do?
No, I didn't. I worked in a local factory,
mm-hmm.
a dyeing factory. They dyed rayon, nylon, orlon, various synthetic fibers. And it was only a couple blocks from the house, so I had a job there. I always intended to save up money and go to college, but unfortunately I bought a car and there were girls involved and money just drifted away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it got to be. I was probably saved by the draft because then I was eligible for the GI Bill,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I did later.
Now, when were you drafted?
I was drafted on October 7th, 1952. I was 20 and a half years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept waiting and waiting. I guess they drafted people over 20 at that point in time. That was the common. When you hit 20, then I went down to Albany for the physical. Went to Amsterdam, was local board 38 in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
They put us on a train and we went to Albany and walked up from what was then the railroad station up to a building where they had all of the medical facilities for the inspections and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think it was the old post office building, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's right on the corner of State and Pearl, I think, downtown.
Yeah, and probably.
Or Broadway, Broadway and State, I believe. Now, you were drafted into the Army?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And where did they send you for your basic training?
Basic training was at Camp Breckenridge, Kentucky. It was a large base that had been built for two divisions. That would be approximately 36,000 people in World War II. And they used half of it. And the 101st Airborne Division ran the training program at that point.
Was that your first time away from home?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How difficult was basic training?
Not too difficult, because I wasn't in bad shape at that point. Mm-hmm. The job I had in the factory involved a lot of hauling and stuff like that, piling cases and things like that. The official title was shipping clerk, but it was more of a bulwark job than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Had you ever handled a rifle before you went into the
Oh yeah, Army? we all hunted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, had my own rifle, had my own shotgun, had all that kind of stuff, yeah. Mm-hmm.
After you completed your basic training, did you go on to any additional training after that?
I had taken this AFQT test or whatever they called it, and I qualified for Officers Candidate School, but they had, you know, full up at that point in time, and so they sent us to a leadership school, an NCO school of sorts, and I had the dubious distinction of being the first person bounced out of that class, and it was a series of errors, I suppose. My friends are laughing over here. What happened was, I was on guard duty, and we didn't have our own rifle. We had to go to the supply room, pick up an M1, and the one I picked up, I was in a hurry because a grandmother had died, and I had tried to get a compassionate leave, so I was monkeying around with that. And they gave me a rifle without a sling. So I said, well, I'll come back after I get this other done, and I went down to check with the Red Cross people about a compassionate leave, which was refused because grandparents evidently didn't count. It was just a wild shot. Yeah. I came back, the supply room was closed. And here I was with a rifle with no sling. And guard mount was in a half an hour. So I went to guard mount with a rifle with no sling. You'd have thought that I was trying to assassinate the president or something. They pitched a hissy fit there. And the next day I had to go to the company commander of this unit, and I saluted smartly and said, no excuse, sir. And the next thing you know, I had orders cut, and I was to report to Fort Lewis, Washington, my next duty station. And that was it. So that's my experience. And I'll tell you a story now, because I had served in a line company for about 7 or 8 months, and then they saw that I could chew gum and walk at the same time without tripping too much, and I got sent back to the 9th Regiment Personnel Office, the service company, 9th Infantry. And the reason that that happened was because I had papers that said I was a shipping clerk. Well, as I said, it was more of a bulwark job than a clerk. It got me that spot. And then when I got there, I was able to look at my own records. And those son of a guns had put on, you know, there's a big kind of a salmon-colored card, a stiff card. I can't remember the name of the form. And down at the bottom, they'd written, not suitable for further training. Right on there. Fortunately, I hid that from the people at Oneonta State in Albany, or I don't know what I'd have done. Huh? I don't know. But that was it.
So basically, they had you doing like an on-the-job training. During that time, I mean, what were you doing?
Oh, it's still in Camp Breckenridge?
Yeah.
The NCO school was the kind of thing where you polish the back of your belt buckle and the shoes under the bunk. The soles had to be shined, stuff like that. It was not my type of deal anyway. But it was going okay because the PT and all was not difficult. You could manage that. And it was supposed to be, I think, a month. Very funny thing about that also that I remember. I had friends there that came from George Company, the 502nd Airborne Infantry, where our basic training company. Mm-hmm. And they found out where I was, and they wrote me a letter. And I was sitting on a sandbag reading this letter, and they said, all the people, last names A through H, went to Germany. And here I was sitting on a sandbag in the middle of frozen chosen at that point in time. So that was one of the things that just happened.
When did you go overseas to Korea?
I went over and started over in April. I got there around the first part of May of 1953. Mm-hmm. The war still had 3 or 4 months to go. But
now, how did you get over there? Did you go by ship?
Well, we went to Fort Lewis. I got to Fort Lewis. Some people took a train out. Mm-hmm. And all that, but I blew some money and flew out. Flew from Albany to Detroit to Minneapolis, and then all the way from Minneapolis on one of those Lockheed Constellations, big plane, very high class plane at that time. And I got there 3 days late. I figured, what the hell are they going to do? Send me to Korea?
Yeah.
Which they did. Nobody said a word. I walked in. They gave me $20, which was called the Flying 20, because I was pretty much flat broke at that point. And there was a PX there that sold pitchers of beer for, I don't know, maybe 50 cents, 75 cents. Pretty cheap. And then I went to Tacoma once while we were there, got a bus and went down. That took the Flying 20 right away, and then I was broke again. But then the boat was named the General R.L. Howze, H-O-W-Z-E. And it was a kind of boat that had one smokestack way in the back. Mm-hmm. This was not a big ship. And on the way over, it hit some storms and stuff. Man, that baby bounced. And, you know, you'd stand on the deck and the bow would go right under the water and all that, up it came. Some of us thought we were surely doomed at that point. But
did you get seasick at all?
No, I didn't, but it was very close, because the first night we're on the ship, we left from Seattle and went up what is Puget Sound and then turned west out into the Pacific. When you did that, then the rollers started like that. And we ate at tables standing up with trays, you know, regular cafeteria type trays. And guy across from me, he got sick right there. I almost did at that point, but did not. Which is a fortunate thing, because I was appointed one of the people in the stairwell detail. And the stairwell got messy because this was down 2 or 3 decks. People would get sick and they'd have to try to get up to the top so they could throw them over the rail. And some of them didn't make it. We were packed in there. You almost had to get permission to turn over. These are metal bunks with the canvas thing. Uh-huh. Canvas thing. And it was very tight to roll over there. A friend of mine had joined the Coast Guard. He got a medical discharge from the Coast Guard because he was chronically seasick. Came home and they drafted him. And he was on board the ship. We brought him oranges or anything from the mess every day. Uh-huh. Kept him going. The ship took 18 days to get to Sasebo, Japan. I told you it was a slow boat, slow ship.
How many soldiers were aboard the ship?
I don't know. Maybe 1,000, maybe more.
Now, did you go with your unit, or were you there as like a replacement?
No, this is all replacement stuff.
Okay.
When you landed, we landed in Incheon, and the boat couldn't get up to the dock, so we had to go down these rope things there,
uh-huh.
You know, like you see in the World War II movies, into a LCI and then up onto the deck. Fortunately, this was well beyond the time when people were shooting at those guys, so we got on Korea without any other incident. But
what was your impression of Korea when you got there? I mean, did it smell different, or?
Well, yeah, it was different in a lot of ways. It was pretty well run down.
Mm-hmm.
That territory had been fought over a couple of times. The North Koreans had occupied it. We blew them away. The Chinese came back and blew us away. We came back again. That whole area was pretty well devastated. I remember going through Seoul, and it was pretty much wrecked. Pretty much wrecked. Yeah. And I remember also when we got off the ship at Incheon, we got on a train to go north. And the train was all, the windows were all blown out. It sat on the side of a UN troop coach. And there was bullet holes in it, windows out, and all kinds of stuff, wooden seats. It was not a very plush ride to get up there. And on the way up, I remember two things. Number one, a couple of trains came down from the north. One of them had flat cars with all wrecked equipment, you know, jeeps, mm-hmm. trucks, tanks, everything that had been used up. And another one was a hospital train that came down. You could look in the window and you see these poor guys. That didn't do much for troop morale. No.
No.
And as you said, we were not going over as a unit. We were all replacements. So I went to a repo depot and stayed there probably 3 or 4 days before they got us sorted out and assigned to a division, and the division assigned you to a regiment.
And where were you assigned?
I was assigned to the 2nd Division, 9th Regiment, Easy Company.
Mm-hmm. And whereabouts were you at that point?
At that time, Easy Company and the 9th had taken some casualties, quite a number according to the people, at a place called Hill 355, and they were refitting. We're back in reserve area, which was very fortunate. It would have been tougher by far to go into a new unit when they were online mm-hmm. in active combat. But I had 2-3 weeks there, and then we moved up to the Kansas line, spent some time there before we actually went up to the MLR.
And what does MLR stand for?
Main Line of Resistance.
Okay.
That was the front line.
Okay. Yeah. And when did you see your first combat action?
I think we got up to the Kansas line was a fallback position with all bunkers and trenches and barbed wire, etc. We were there for a couple of weeks, and it was pretty poor. It rained all the time, and the damn trenches were full of water and everything. We were all mud, crap. And we went up online, I think, probably about the middle of June. Mm-hmm. And we stayed there until the war ended, which was, I remember this date, July 27th, 1953, at 10 o'clock at night, they shut it down. I remember that clearly.
Was there any celebration at that point?
Not by us.
Uh-huh.
A lieutenant came by, and I was on a 50 caliber crew at the point. I'll tell you a story about that later. And we unloaded all the weapons, he said. As soon as he left, we loaded them back up again. Because we had heard all this stuff about wars are going to be over, wars going to be over. It was before when I was in basic training, they were talking about, well, it's over. And then on the ship, on the way over, well, it's over. And all this time, it's over, but it didn't happen. But it finally did on July 27th. And just before the end, about 9 o'clock, the Chinese let loose with a whole bunch of mortars. And somebody told me their mortars were trigger mortars. Our mortars had a fixed fire pin. You dropped the shell and up she went. But they had trigger mortars. Now, maybe this is true or not, I don't know. But they blew off a whole bunch of ammo at that point in time. We just sat there, waited it out. Then it was over, very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Very quiet at that point. We looked at each other, said, hey, you don't think? We said, yeah, maybe. But then it did, it helped.
Now, did you have any close combat experience with either the North Koreans or the Chinese?
Well, we were on in the edge of the Kumar Valley. On the east edge of the Kumar Valley was a small group of hills called the Boomerang.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the Boomerang was, wasn't the highest ground around. The highest ground was a hill called Hill 1062, which was off to our right front. And the Chinese had that. And nobody was going to want to take that because that's a long haul up that kind of hill. I was on the 50 caliber crew, so I avoided going out on patrols.
Mm-hmm.
That was the worst duty at that point in time. And we were supposed to be notified where the patrols were and all that kind of stuff, be in close contact, and that failed a few times. Once we pinned down one of our own patrols, unfortunately we missed everybody. And like that. See, the 50 caliber was not TONE for a rifle company, but it came with a mess truck. The old World War II mess trucks had a ring mount over the passenger side of the cab, and the company commander was a new guy from West Point. Captain Bell was his name. Really nice guy and an intelligent leader. And he took that off, got a tripod mount somewhere, and he picked five guys to run it, and I was one of them. The problem with this was none of us had heavy weapons training. We were light weapons infantry. 30 caliber was as high as it went. And they gave us a manual for this thing. Well, you take the back plate off where the triggers are, and inside there was a thing called a timing screw. And after a while, it wasn't running right. We'd fire 8 or 10 rounds, jam, then we'd have to fool around with it, unjam it, get it back going again. And eventually it got so bad that we sent it back to ordnance, and they sent us up what looked like it came out of one of the John Wayne movies of World War II. It was one of these water-cooled 30s, you know, the big fat barrel, a 1918 gun, basically. The only thing was they didn't send up the tank and the water hoses. So we had to whittle out plugs to put in the holes where the hoses were, and we filled the thing up with our canteens. But if you fired more than maybe 100 rounds with it, as we did once, the steam would build up and the cork blew out, and there was all the steam coming out of it. This war was run on the cheap, I tell you. The sea rations were 1942, and 10 years in storage had not improved their flavor.
You were eating 10-year-old sea rations?
Yeah. And the sea rations, they came in a box of 4 cans, and then the fourth can, the 3 with fruit, and the fourth can had powdered coffee and powdered milk and a candy thing and stuff like that. The candy, by that time, some of it was chocolate and some was kind of a jellied candy. It was like hockey pucks. They're really quite bad. But we ate it. Because on the boomerang, you couldn't, the company mess was truck was back maybe a mile or two, and they could only use that road at night. So most of the time we ate sea rations. And some of them were really atrocious. They had one called sausage patties and gravy. And this was poor. And nobody that I knew liked that. And they would say on the top what it was. So the guy went back to the supply dump to get the sea ration for the day. He would bring them up and turn the cans upside down. And then you would pick. So, you know, spaghetti and meatballs wasn't too bad. It was like Chef Boyardee.
Yeah.
It was not hot cuisine, but it was palatable. And the hash wasn't too bad either. And then there was something else, I think, with noodles, and that wasn't good. But the sausage patties and gravy, I remember that. I got stuck with that a couple of times. They were bad. Then sometimes in the morning they would bring up actual food like scrambled eggs, which had been scrambled hours before, and pancakes, and all this. And some of the stuff they would bring up in these thermal cans. And I swear to God that they'd use these thermal cans for gasoline at one time too, because all of it had a faint taste of SO Extra or something like that. You know? Yeah.
Now, what about your clothing and your boots? Were they adequate?
Well, this was summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were okay. The clothing was okay. For quite a while, we didn't get too much opportunity to wash. But we fixed that. They had engineering sticks, you know. They had a kind of like a groove, they used them for barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
And we found some of those, and over the hill from our position, Korea was a lot of like sandstone, and springs would like seep out. And we found one down the hill, right by the Jeep trail that went up. And we made a kind of like an aqueduct. We tied some of these together. Commo wire was for radios and the field phones, the EA field phones, basically. And we tied this all together, and so it came out so we could get under that, and we had a shower. There's not a great deal of water, but some water came out.
Mm-hmm.
After the war ended, they had shower points. And you could go back there, a big tent, and you left everything except your boots, your cartridge belt, your helmet, your weapon, and everything else was gone, and you got clean pants, clean underwear, clean shirts, all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. socks. But that wasn't a daily occurrence. It was a kind of, it took your turn rare to do that.
Now, how much time did you spend in Korea, all total?
Let's see, I was there about 15 months. I had picked up, they had a point system.
Mm-hmm.
You got 4 points a month for being on line, 3 points in close reserve, and then 2 points for rear echelon. You needed 36 points to graduate. And at the wartime ended, I think I had 12 amassed. Then the points stopped. They didn't have them after that. And so that got me out of there in July of 1954.
Now, once the war ended, what did they have you doing?
Well, that was a sore spot with us. We all thought, hell, the war's over. The 2nd Division's going home, right? And we thought that for about a month, and then we realized that this was not going to happen. Want me to continue on?
Yeah, I'm just going to turn, I forgot to turn this off.
Okay. We moved back, the demilitarized zone was, I don't know, about 3 miles wide or something like that. So we moved back a mile and a half, or a mile and a quarter, or some space like that. And we built all new fortifications. We spent the whole summer and into the fall digging again.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the 9th Infantry Regiment was paired with the Thailand Battalion. And the Thailanders did not like to dig. You know, the British had people there, the French had people there, all kinds of Australians and Greeks. Ours happened to be the Thailand Battalion. So at different times, we were moved into areas that they had spent time in and didn't do anything. So we had to, so eventually, by the fall, it was another whole line, complete with landmines, concertina wire, double apron with concertina thrown in. Get your hands cut up pretty much by that stuff. Because there wasn't much in the way of gloves that I remember at that point. And that's what we did. That was our summer vacation in sunny Korea.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any sort of R&R at all?
Yes. I got R&R. I was on R&R. After I transferred down to regimental service company, my R&R time came up. I went to R&R. This is a family show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. And did you have much contact or interaction with the Korean people?
No, because they weren't supposed to, there was a big zone behind the line where they weren't supposed to be, although they were in different categories. After the war ended, they kind of seeped back into it, but they were not supposed to be anywhere near the line. So we didn't have any situations like arose in Vietnam or any place like that, or today in Afghanistan, where our people are right mixed in with a civilian population. That would have happened early in the war when I wasn't there. But by the time I got there, it was like World War I time, you know. There was a definite line, and there were all constant brushes back and forth. Somebody take a hill, they had to take it back, some kind of stuff like that, and patrol actions, and that was what was going on.
Your unit, once you got there, did your unit suffer many casualties?
When we were online, I think there were about 15 casualties, none dead, just wounded, that I know. Now, the company was spread out, and I had been in the 3rd platoon, but they took us out of that platoon and set us up as this almost autonomous unit with the 50 caliber, the five of us. In fact, we didn't have to put up with the platoon leader, the second lieutenants, or anybody, just the first sergeant, whose name was Pace. And I think Pace thought that I was just one of these wise-ass New Yorkers. And Pace was dead on with that one, of course, but eventually, by the time I got ready to leave and go to a service company, he was great, he was okay. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you don't have to go, you know, you can stay here. I thought that went over for about 3 seconds. And then I said, nah, I think we'll go back. Because they had Quonset huts and tents with floors, wood floors, and this was living.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were up online, were you living in bunkers or?
Bunkers, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What about things like rats or snakes?
Rats and snakes. I have a rat story. We had sleeping bunkers down the back slope, and most of the action took place at night. Hardly anything happened in the daytime because of our superiority with the Air Force and the artillery. They didn't challenge that very much. I was in there one time, and a rat was there in the car. I had a .45, and I said, I'm going to fix that damn rat, and I shot the rat. Anybody with smarts would know you're not supposed to discharge a .45 in narrow confines like that. It took me a couple of days to get my hearing back. And that's probably why I'm wearing hearing aids today. Wow, that was a mistake. But I got the rat, boys. And then a snake. Okay. We were clearing out this was when I think we were back on the Kansas line. The war wasn't over yet. And they had an M4 tank with a dozer blade on it, the Sherman tank. Mm-hmm. And the driver sat with his, just looking over the top of the blade, and he had this hatch to come up. And we were kind of providing security for this, and we're walking alongside and watching it, and bulldozing these straw houses out of the way to make sure that, you know, this would not give cover to the Chinks or whoever wanted it, the North Koreans. And the guy bulldozed over a great big snake. It come right over the top. He drove down that hatch and popped right up the top. By the time the tank stopped, the snake had been totally squashed. Huh. It had to have been 5-6 feet long. It's the only one I saw.
Huh. Now, when did you end up leaving Korea?
I left in July of 1954.
And where did they send you next after you left?
Where did I go?
Yeah.
My time wasn't up till October. Mm-hmm. But to see, they weren't about to reassign me somewhere. So I got out a couple months.
So you got an early out. Yeah. Where were you discharged from?
Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. Went to Camp Kilmer, and first thing I did, I got out of there, and there was a clothing store nearby, and I bought real clothes, clothes.
Now, just going back to Korea for a minute, you did receive the CIB.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What did you have to do to earn the CIB? Were you out online for?
I think it was a month or something like that. Okay. I don't know what the qualifications were, but the entire company received the CIB at that point.
Okay. So at Kilmer, you decided not to make the Army a career.
In Camp Kilmer, just as we were getting our last pay and all that, all this stuff had been the medical stuff all taken care of. This old first sergeant gets up on the stage and this little other time says, "Boys," says, "you better re-enlist, re-up." He says, "it's mighty cold out there." Well, by this time it was August and it was hotter than hell out there. We laughed and everybody went away. That was the end of that. I had no intention because the pay wasn't all that great. You know, I see today people make what I would consider to be, wow, my first Army pay was $67. And of course, there was no bonus or anything, just $67. And if you came back in, you could come in at your own rank. Well, mine is state PFC.
Oh, okay.
What happened to that was the first sergeant in Company E that I eventually got on with, he had put me in for corporal, but then I transferred, and they didn't take that with him. When I got to the personnel office, this was the officer's record section. The guy was a World War II holdover chief warrant officer. And he was, we can't say what he was because again, this is a family show. But nobody liked this guy. It was really, nobody got promoted, nothing. It was kind of like a war, maybe it was Captain Queeg like from the Caine Mutiny kind of a deal. And that was it. But I ignored him most of the time. He had an office way down at the end of this Quonset Hut. And my job was to type up the efficiency reports. Because every officer had an efficiency report at least once a year, or every time they changed duty stations, they'd have an efficiency report. And then the person, his superior officer doing the efficiency report, would submit a handwritten one to me.
Yeah.
And then I'd have to translate whatever the hell they said onto a regular form that went to the Department of Defense. And that was basically my job. And every 3 years they had to reapply for reinstatement and continue on. There was a reenlistment thing for them. Well, the chief warrant officer had to apply, and he did. And then the mail came in from the Department of Defense, from the Pentagon. And one of my jobs, I opened the mail, and I opened that up, and there's Chief Warrant Officer Moraes' reenlistment. They turned him down because his efficiency report wasn't very good. So I notified a couple of my friends there. I said, "Watch this." And I marched down to the end, and I saluted, which I didn't know what they were doing. I laid down on his desk, did a quick about face, and walked back. He looked at that, and then he went away. We didn't see too much of him after that. But I was almost gone anyway. So that was my experience. I had one other experience down there. Since I was still a PFC, I still was eligible for guard duty. This was a great benefit of Bonanza. And so I was on guard mount one night. I had the first shift. It was still daylight. And across a little barbed wire fence was the Thailand headquarters, this night regiment headquarters and the Thailand battalion headquarters. So I'm walking along, walking my post in a military manner, as they said, and I hear this screaming and hollering, and I see three young kids. Now, the people hired Korean boys as chogi boys to do housework, chores, and cleaning up kitchens and stuff like that, and there were three Thailand people, probably officers, chasing these kids. They were running right over towards me because there was a latrine there covered up with a tent. You know, and then you go into the latrines and there was just a tent over them. Not a big tent, but
right.
You know, just a tent. These kids ran in the tent, the latrine. Bad, bad move. They shot them. They started popping them off right there. I think they had carbines, and they must have killed them. And here I am with an M1 with one clip. I should have done it. They're right out in the open, 50 yards away. I'd have gotten a ride back home, but it might have been to Leavenworth, I don't know. They killed those, I'm sure they killed them. I called for the sergeant of the guard, and he called for the officer of the day, and all kinds of people around. They moved me right directly away from that scene, so I didn't find out what all happened. I should have done that.
Were you affected by any tropical diseases at all, like malaria? Or?
No. What they had when I first got there, they had a pill called chloroquine. It was a white pill, and it wasn't coated or anything. You know, chloroquine is a very bitter substance. So every Sunday, you walk through the mess line with your little kit, and they give you one of these, and you're supposed to eat it. Then I found out that this would merely quell the symptoms of malaria. It would not cure malaria, nor would it prevent you from getting it. It would just make sure you could stay there and give your service to the government of the United States of America. After that, I did whatever I could to get rid of that chloroquine pill. Mm-hmm. And I never got that anyway. There was one thing that some people got. A couple people in our company got this. It was called hemorrhagic fever. It was kind of like, came from rat bites, lice and rats and stuff. Mm-hmm. Very similar to the Black Plague of the Middle Ages. Hemorrhagic fever. When you got that, you were pretty, I think the casualty rate was like 90% or something. Then, and I don't think it was widespread, but there was no shot, couldn't get a shot.
Yeah. So it was fatal?
90% of the time it was fatal, yeah.
Well. All right, once you were discharged, did you make use of the GI Bill at that point?
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to SUNY Oneonta. Mm-hmm.
And you got your degree in?
1958. And then I went to Albany. Well, by that time, for a master's, the GI Bill had expired. I only got, I think it was, $110 a month. Mm-hmm. But at that time, the State University in New York, and those of you who are parents having children in college now would be pleased to know, there was no tuition in the State University of New York at that time. And so $110 a month, five of us, all veterans, rented an apartment for $60 a month, so that's $15 out of that. The rest was all beer money and gasoline and mm-hmm. whatever entertainments that you wanted.
Okay.
And that was pretty good. I got married in my junior year, and then it went up to $135 a month. They raised it up.
Okay. And you became a teacher and taught for?
I got a job at Little Falls High School in mm-hmm. Little Falls, New York. And that was close to home. I knew a lot of people in Little Falls. In St. Johnsville, where I went to high school, it's about 10 miles away or less. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there for 34 years. I didn't intend to stay, but I did. Mm-hmm.
Now, did you stay in contact with anyone you were in the service with?
Yeah. In fact, I'm going over to New Hampshire this summer to see a buddy of mine who was in Company E of the 9th Infantry. I've seen a few of them, but very rarely. Some of the guys I was in basic training with were from Hempstead in New York. Oh. Joe Campo still lives there, and Dave Crane. Dave died about 10 years ago.
Dave Crane was the banker, wasn't he?
Yes, he worked for the Key Bank, yeah. Okay. Did you know Dave?
Yes. Yeah. Many years ago.
He was in Camp Breckenridge with me, he and Joe and I. Mm-hmm. And I think he's been dead at least 10 years. But for a while, Joe and I and our wives would go. Mm-hmm. But then, last couple of years, we kind of slacked off on that. I should call him.
Have you attended any unit reunions? Or division reunions?
No. Somebody convinced me quite a while ago, a World War II veteran, to join the 2nd Infantry Division Association, mm-hmm. which I did for a few years, but then I stopped because the reunions were mostly World War II people, probably, and mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody that I knew would be there, so I didn't do that.
Did you join the Legion or the VFW?
Both, yes, that joined both. The VFW eventually went kaput in St. John's mm-hmm. close, so I still belong to the Legion there.
Mm-hmm. How do you think your time in the service changed or affected your life?
I was growing up anyway. And I tried not to let it bother me too much. Mm-hmm. One of the guys who was coming with us today was wounded with it for his cavalry, and he still goes treatments. He had a treatment yesterday, so it didn't come today. And he said, I treat it too lightly. Well, hey, what are you going to cry? You have to. So therefore, I don't know if it affected me or not.
Do you think you would have gone on to college had it not been for the GI Bill?
I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't going anywhere before I was drafted, but one of the reasons was I knew I was going to be drafted. And it took a long time for them to get to me. I expected to be drafted maybe 1951, but they didn't get to me until 52. Mm-hmm. So that was my excuse anyway for not doing anything serious.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to touch on before we end the interview?
I don't know. I don't know. A friend of mine landed a D-Day in Normandy, mm-hmm. and he said to me once, it was a great experience for a young man if you lived through it. And so, I guess it was, no, I don't think so. Charlie might have been right, but I won't necessarily subscribe to that.
Did you see any USO shows when you were over in Korea?
Oh yeah, yeah. Marilyn Monroe came. I got to go to see Marilyn Monroe. She wore a great big purple dress, was spray painted on, and like that was very good. Then there were some others that were not quite as good. Some people who were, their talents weren't great. Their effort was good. They tried, but they weren't really great. And I can't remember what else I got to do. Not too much. The infantry didn't get to do a whole lot of things. We were on the tail end of everything. I guess, well, we did have a New Year's party. This was just before I went to the service company. And we were in our tents, and we had stopped digging and stuff like that because everything was frozen. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we were doing, not a whole lot. And everybody threw some money, and I don't remember how much. The company commander sent the deuce and a half back to probably in China or someplace, a port, and loaded it up with beer. It was beer from Detroit, Michigan, called Goebel's Golden Bantam. And I think it was basically green. I don't know if they had brewed that especially for St. Patrick's Day or what, but we drank that, and it was, you know, here we are, way halfway around the world, freezing to death in a tent with one stove at one end, and the tent ran on kerosene. It was a little pot-bellied thing. And if you stood next to it, you'd roast. You stood 10 feet away, you'd freeze. There we were, drinking this cheap beer and all that. And everybody back home was still enjoying themselves. At least in World War II, there were various hardships. There was rationing that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and all kinds of air raid things and all that, and all kinds of other stuff. But in the Korean War, people went right on like nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. I came home, and I went over to the Century Hotel in Mindenville, the Century Tavern. You've been there, Donnie, many times, brother. I get up to the bar. It's the first Saturday night I was home. I'm going to buy a drink. And a guy came up, I think it was George Gunner, says, hey, how have you been? I haven't seen you in a while. Where have you been? I said, I've been away. Then the bartender, Durkee, said, I'm going to buy you a drink. Oh, good. He says, as soon as there aren't so many people around, I don't know what that had to do with it, but I never got the drink, and nobody even knew that I was gone. that was the way it went, I guess. Funny. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for your interview.
My pleasure.